Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Think back 25 years or so. The issue then wasn't talking to Hamas. The issue was then talking to the PLO.
Our guest is Mark Brzezinski, a Jewish-American international affairs and law expert who joins us to talk about his longstanding hope for peace in Palestine and his amazement at watching the crowds in Washington, D.C., sharing new hope for the future during the Obama inauguration. In the days leading up to the Obama inauguration, The Guardian's Washington, D.C.-based reporter Suzanne Goldenberg wrote that the incoming administration was prepared to abandon George Bush's doctrine of isolating Hamas. She outlined the possibility that Barack Obama would establish a channel to the Islamist organization, and sources close to the transition team said there would be contacts with Hamas which could be initiated through the U.S. intelligence services. That, said Goldenberg, would represent a definitive break with the Bush presidency's ostracizing of the group. The U.S. press largely ignored the story, but Goldenberg's phrasing led us to ask, if Obama would meet with Hamas, why wouldn't he reach out with some form of call to peace in Gaza just before his inauguration? There were thousands of people protesting Israel's actions, and the U.S. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was calling for investigations.
I'm not able to describe how I'm feeling, having seen this sight of the bombing of the United Nations compound. Everyone is smelling this burning. Still, it is still burning. It is an outrageous and totally unacceptable attack against the United Nations. Where civilians have been killed, there has to be a thorough investigation, full explanations, and where it is required, accountability. I appeal to Fatah, Hamas, to all Palestinian factions to reunite within the framework of the legitimate Palestinian Authority. The repeated violence felt by Palestinians and Israelis is a mark of collective political failure.
We researched Middle East peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians, that long history of false starts, great breakthroughs, followed by more false starts. And that research we did led us to Mark A. Brzezinski. His website is MiddleEast.org, and he is Washington representative of the Goals for Americans Foundation and writes and speaks about U.S. foreign policy, the Middle East, and U.S.-Israeli relations. Mark Brzezinski was associate editor of World View magazine in New York and interview editor of the Middle East magazine in London. He was Washington representative of the World Jewish Congress from 1977 to 1984 and special assistant to Philip M. Klutznik, president of both B'nai B'rith International and the World Jewish Congress, and a former Secretary of Commerce under Jimmy Carter. As we discussed in interview, Mark Brzezinski offered me a very recent op-ed piece yet to be published, outlining more of his story of work on behalf of negotiations dating back to the 1970s, when he personally met alone with Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and encouraged him to visit Israel, which he ultimately did. More recently, Mark Brzezinski met with Hamas leaders, some of those who could possibly get to talk with U.S. officials one day. We spoke as he watched the inaugural events in Washington, D.C. with mixed sentiments. Mark Brzezinski, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's quite an interesting, unprecedented time here in Washington.
It must be mobbed there. Has there been a great deal of difficulty getting around?
You know, I was down at DuPont Circle and with some of the protesters, very interesting protest groups, and up at Union Station and a little bit around the mall. And sure, I've never quite seen anything like this, but it isn't so much the crowds that I'm startled by, because I've been in Washington when there have been crowds, although it might be the biggest ever. It's the enthusiasm. It's the hubbub. It's not just the sense of change, but there's this tremendous hope and spirit that people have that, oh my God, after all these years of embarrassment and then the economic collapse, we're finally going to have a new president. And people, even I am caught up in the hoopla. You should see pictures of me with my Obama scarf and my Obama hat. This isn't me. But
And yet you're somewhat skeptical, I know, about what will unfold as far as U.S. foreign policy. And you've been at this a while, so you can put this all in so much historical context.
Yes, I was reflecting back myself. You know, 1993, the Oslo peace process, a week or 10 days before, they announced this huge breakthrough, and everybody is so optimistic, and all my friends are going to the White House lawn, and I was on CTV, the Good Morning Canada program, which was broadcasting live, and I was in their studio doing the Washington commentary, and I expressed on that day a great deal of skepticism. I explained my reasons why. I said it was a marriage of the oddest of the odd couples that was destined for divorce. The only question was how long they'd stay together, how bitter the divorce would be. They were getting into it with different expectations, and we're at another time of great euphoria and great sense of, my God, Obama, he's so different, and surely he's going to change our policy, and he's going to make this big speech to the Muslim world that we're already hearing about. And yet, if you discount the difference in personality, style, sincerity, if you actually look at the players, at the issues, and at what's going on, it's the same old Washington, it's the same old people, it's the same old groups, it's the same old lobbies. The man who promised us that lobbies weren't going to play a big part in his administration has chosen the Israel lobby's number one man to bring him back as his personal White House and State Department advisor on the Middle East, Dennis Ross, of course.
And then we have Rahm Emanuel as well.
Well, okay, Rahm, okay, sure enough. Essentially, Rahm was brought to Washington again as an Israeli lobby personality, placed in the Clinton White House. And then, of course, Martin Indyg plays his role at the Saban Center. And even when PBS does a report about Gaza, as they did recently, they put on somebody who has an Arab name, Telhami, but in reality, it's Israel Lobby 1 versus Israel Lobby 2, because they put someone from the Near East Institute in juxtaposition to someone from the Saban Center, which is essentially Israel Lobby 2 think tank, with no Arab personalities, and they talk about Hamas without ever asking anybody in Hamas to explain to us what they're all about. So Obama comes to office at a time of tremendous desire for change. There's this huge pent-up feeling that our country needs to go in new directions, both foreign policy and domestic. And there will be some new directions in some important issues. But on the Middle East, I'm more than skeptical. I think it's quite a conspiracy. What I expect to happen is Obama, which really means Rahm and Dennis and Hillary, because those are the people that are going to do this full-time every day.
We should say here, Dennis Ross, a senior fellow at the Near East Policy Center, appointed to be top envoy to the Middle East. And Ross was considered a leading hawk when he served under former President George H.W. Bush. Rahm Emanuel is now Barack Obama's chief of staff. Rahm Emanuel, controversial within the Democratic Party, also as something of a conservative, a hawk, but because his father served with the Irgun, a militant Jewish organization in Israel. And, of course, Barack Obama's designated Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton.
They're going to put forward the two-state solution. They're going to try to get Syria involved in some kind of a deal. But it's really all about Iran. It's really all about controlling the region. And the two-state solution that started out as an honorable and thoughtful approach that just might possibly be able to end this conflict on reasonable terms has turned into a poison pill. The Palestinians are being asked to swallow something which would, at best, put them on permanent Bantustans and make them of the status of Indians. And even if Abbas were to go along with it, because after all, he's paid a great deal of money and given a lot of arms and kept in office, so he has to cough up a variety of things along the way, it's permanent war within the Arab and Muslim and Palestinian worlds, because a lot of people are never going to accept that permanent disenfranchisement. And within a year or two, that will become clear. There's no way this group of people is going to actually endorse an honorable two-state solution, which it's probably too late for, unless the only possibility would be a president that actually imposed a solution that reversed much that has happened in the last 20 or 25 years, which is politically inconceivable. It's theoretically possible. So, yes, I'm extremely skeptical. And worse than that, here's the president elected on an anti-war platform who is committed to doubling our troops in Afghanistan, even though the Brits and the NATO officials have said that's not the way to go. That's not really going to help the situation in Afghanistan. So we're taking some troops out of Iraq. We're going to push them into Afghanistan, even against Karzai's wishes. Even he has made statements that this is not what he wants. And my analysis would be this has got to be much bigger than Afghanistan. It's got to be in preparations for both Iran and Pakistan, should Pakistan take the turn that people have been predicting and which we have been pushing it toward.
You're seeing a positioning of the U.S. force in Afghanistan puts us in a position to actually do the unthinkable, you know, go to war against Iran?
It is not unthinkable. It's been widely discussed and widely planned for. And although I think Obama personally is not of this persuasion, he has already shown us that he knows the role of the president is to cater to the interest groups and to those who brought him to the position he's in. And when it comes to foreign policy, that has been even more traditional than when it comes to domestic policy. So I do expect considerable domestic policy changes. Of course, we're in this economic crisis. Foreign policy, my best guess is the Obama bubble will burst in the year that's already started. He will find himself up against the proverbial rock in the hard place. His advisors are mostly hardline types. They'll play the diplomacy card so that they can pretend that they really, really, really tried. But in the end, we're positioning stronger military forces in the region and building up more military forces, which the sinking economy, of course, helps because more and more people are now willing to sign up for the military. I foresee my best analysis, it's not a guess, it's a sort of analysis based on history and based on watching these things develop over the years, is we will find more war coming from Barack than we will less. He'll do symbolic things. He'll close Guantanamo. He will start withdrawing troops from Iraq, which they think they have under control. I'm not at all sure they do. It looks to me like Iraq is really headed for a breakup, the southern part becoming sort of autonomous like the Kurdish region. But politics tends to be short-term in today's Washington. It tends to be, what are we going to do this week and next year? There are very, very few people that they bring into government that say, if you take this course, here's the likely ramifications 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road. Everybody just sort of glazes over when you talk to them like that because they're so busy just keeping their fingers in the dike of the moment.
Do you think you could convince Barack Obama, if you had a little bit of his time, to try to at least achieve something where maybe there could be a transitional period? Let's just say Israel backs away from its policy of assassinating members of Hamas. You know, much as the PLO was able to become transformed into more of a political organization, the world accepted it as such eventually. Maybe that could happen with Hamas if Barack Obama were to soften his language and get Israel to just get rid of that one policy of assassination.
Well, nice of you to phrase it in such terms. And of course, sometimes in our dreams, we have the dream that we get 5 minutes with the president, or at least he's going to read a memo that we're going to write for him. Let me tell you this apropos story to show you how bad things are, and they're much worse now than when this took place. When I first got involved in these things, it was Nahum Goldman, the president of the World Jewish Congress, the founder of the World Zionist Organization, who asked me, just after law school, to work with him and to represent the World Jewish Congress in Washington. Okay, Nahum at the time, and look at his stature, the man who founded the World Jewish Congress, the man who founded the World Zionist Organization, the man who was here in 48 in Washington representing David Ben-Gurion, he was saying to Jimmy Carter, who he had met with before he met with me, he was saying, you must impose a solution, Jimmy Carter. You must impose it, because if you do not, everything will get worse year after year, and it will be harder and harder, right now you must stop the settlements that have just started because this was 1976, and here's what you must do. Okay, Carter actually agreed with him. But when a year later Nahum came back to Washington, as he normally did every year or two, he had 11 different passports and he lived in Paris most of the time. But of course he went to Israel all the time. The word came from the White House, Nahum, I love you. You know I agree with you. I'm trying real hard. You know I'm hoping to have a second term, and I'll even try harder. But I'm sorry, Nahum, I can't see you. The pressures are too great. They know what you're telling me. Your own people know, and the pressure is too great. My own advisors tell me I can't afford the political risk of even seeing you again. I assure you, the situation today is by a factor of 10 or 100 worse than it was then. Nobody who even thinks like I do, and there's people of considerable stature and considerable influence who actually think this way, but they don't know what to do, and they don't have maybe the historical background, and they don't have all the facts at their fingertips. Dennis and Raham are the gatekeepers, and Hillary, and I would find it amazing if anyone who thinks like I do ever gets to talk to him in the 4 to 8 years that he'll be president.
Before leaving office, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice helped negotiate an agreement that puts the U.S. at Gaza's borders. What does that do?
You're absolutely right to raise it. It's a major, major thing. In fact, I don't even know if the actual text is available. I've been traveling and busy. I haven't read the actual text. And I have to assume the Obama people knew about this and, in fact, didn't put their foot down and say no. They might have even wanted this to be locked in before they got there. We, the Americans, for the first time, have now signed a treaty with Israel, or some kind of agreement with Israel, that makes us the co-warden of the Gaza prison ghetto. And it should never have been done. But that's not the worst thing that Condi did. The terrible embarrassment that after watering down the UN resolution, after delaying the UN vote, then after watering it down, after tedious negotiations that she was in charge of, and she had told everyone the United States was going to vote in favor of this very milquetoast, very late in the day, very watered-down resolution. Then, according to the Israeli prime minister, who's made no secret of this because he's told the Israeli people, he's given interviews saying this is what happened, he picks up the phone and calls George at the last minute, and George pretends he doesn't know what Condi's doing. And Olmert even says he takes him out of a meeting. He was told the president's busy and will call him back, and he says, no, I need the president now, as if he's the president. And then apparently George calls Condi and tells her that the very resolution she herself has negotiated and that's been so watered down to accommodate the United States, he's ordering her not to vote in favor of it. Well, at least she abstained instead of vetoing it. But Jesus, what has become of dignity and what has become of decorum? And Condi really shows her true stripes at the last moment. Just one more person saluting the president, and the Israelis, I should add.
Is there anything in that history that you know so well that you can refer to as an opening, a possibility that exists now that you can point to and say, look, here's something that could work for peace activists, for people who care about Palestinian lives to take advantage of and try to push for?
But you're asking the $64,000 lottery question. I don't any longer see this in terms of Israel and Palestine. I see it in terms of the region. And the region goes from North Africa to Pakistan. Now, the bigger threatening situations for our interests are Pakistan and Iran. But then again, how do you define our interests? If you put aside domestic politics, you put aside funders, you put aside what I call the extended Israeli Jewish lobby, and you said, what would be good for the people of the Middle East and the people of the United States and the people of the world so that in the next 5 to 10 to 15 years, a different reality came to pass? I do think back to a talk with Andy Young some years ago before anybody had heard of Obama. And I was at a conference with him, a little social reception one evening, and had 5-10 minutes alone with him. And as you know, he had been very concerned in his days at the UN, and he, being Jimmy Carter's man at the UN, had been told at that time, huh, I didn't realize how relevant this would be. Think back 25 years or so. The issue then wasn't talking to Hamas. The issue was then talking to the PLO. And de Jong took a step. He was the UN ambassador. He talked to the PLO man at the UN, which was his job, frankly, at a time when the Israelis arrested you if you talked to the PLO and were an Israeli citizen, and when the American policy was we would not have any discussions with a terrorist group. Jimmy, the president and the personal friend of Andy Young, didn't even have the political strength to resist the calls for Andy's dismissal. And Andy was forced to resign from his job as UN ambassador, not because he'd done the wrong thing, but because he'd done the right thing, and because the president of the United States didn't have the political gut and strength to even keep his friend in the job. Now we're in a somewhat similar situation, the issue of talking to Hamas. That's the wrong phrasing. The right phrasing is, what would a real solution look like, and how would that real solution change the region and change the American connection with the region? Well, people like me, even though I'm Jewish and came to Washington representing the World Jewish Congress, as you know, it was some years ago, people like me would like to see a whole new Middle East and a whole new relationship between Israel and the people of Palestine and the Arab world. I'd like to see, you know, you get on a plane in Washington, you fly to New York, you fly to Colorado, you fly. I'd like to see people being able to fly from one city to the next with very little restriction and very little trouble. The only way that can come about and be stabilized is for the Israelis to go through a catharsis similar, many differences, but similar to what the white South Africans went through in the days of apartheid, when they looked at the future and they said to themselves, we're better off making some kind of a deal now, as bitter as it is, as harsh as it's going to be for us, because at least we're going to be able to survive in this region, and at least the world is going to get off our back. There are many distinctions and many differences, so I don't want to say it's just as easy as what Botha did. It'd be harder for the Israelis to do this, but it involves more than declaring a Palestinian state. The wall is a symbolic thing. The state that would have to come about would be a state where a Palestinian in Ramallah or in Bethlehem or in Beit Jala or in Nablus would be able to come to Jerusalem and have dinner, would be able to go to Tel Aviv and go to the beach. That would be a real peace. They'd be Palestinians living in a Palestinian state, but they would be able to go to their own historical places, just like the Jews would be able to go. That concept is the concept that people 20 and 30 years ago who thought of a Palestinian state had at the time. Nobody at the time imagined a wall. Nobody at the time imagined checkpoints. Nobody imagined bypass roads, Jews only here, this and that. The well is now so poisoned that it needs total purification. And as bright and thoughtful a man as Barack Obama is, and what he might know in his own soul. After all, this is a guy who actually did not only listen to Reverend Wright, but Reverend Wright was a good friend of his and was his mentor. It's kind of relevant to our discussion, too, because Reverend Wright did give a big speech on Sunday here, and the Washington Post actually did quite an interesting write-up about it. And a lot of prominent blacks attended, including the president of the college where Martin Luther King went to school and where the King Peace Center is.
What we're seeing in Washington almost seems like a declaration of an end to racism, and yet here we have an excruciating situation where the Israelis have just killed many civilian Palestinians and basically declared them to be able to be killed and so reduce their standing as a people.
Yes, I'm sorry to have to say this because I fought a good part of my younger life against this. And I thought, what in the world is the UN doing when they did it? Zionism as it has come to be, and there's many different kinds of Zionism. Nahum's Zionism wasn't racism. Nahum founded the World Zionist Organization. But Zionism as it has come to be in practice is racism. And that's why the Israelis worked so hard to get that UN resolution rescinded when they could. Where does that take us? Last Thursday, the UN General Assembly held an emergency meeting to say, hey, Israel, live up to Security Council resolutions, and we condemn what you're doing. What did the Israelis do? They bombed UN headquarters in Gaza. Just happened that they did it on the same day the General Assembly was meeting. And most of the gullible media people didn't connect the dots or accepted the Israeli excuse that it was a mistake. It was no mistake. It was there giving the finger to the UN and to everybody else. And then it should come as no secret, when was the ceasefire announced, which of course is not a real ceasefire, but that's another story. It was announced Sunday at 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. That was 7 p.m. Washington time Saturday night. How do you like it? That was the exact time the Obama-Biden train was arriving in Washington. They announced that they're going to have all their troops out of Gaza just as Barack Obama happens to be taking the oath. All of this is designed to send signals from Israel to America that we're in charge. We decide on the timing. We know how to play the game. Our public relations machine is even better than our army. And the rest of you better get used to it. And anybody who crosses us, whether you're a big country like Iran or whether you're the president of the United States, we don't allow anyone to cross us because we know what to do.
Mark Brzezinski, can Americans now feel stronger as they push Obama to respect the rights of Palestinians?
When it comes to Obama, I'd say it's not pressure that's missing. Because I think in his own heart of hearts, he actually understands this reasonably well. In the past, he was friends with Rashid Khalidi. Now, Rashid is a very compromised Palestinian American, but he's still quite a substantial player, quite a thoughtful personality. It's not pressure. It's political calculation. If you're president of the United States and you say, here's what I'd like to do, what's the cost? Well, if your advisors say the cost is billions of dollars and probably the blocking of your other initiatives, and probably you won't get a second term, by the way, then you realize the cost is much greater than the likely result, and I can't afford that cost. And then when you ask who are the friends who are going to support you if you do this, and it's just a very small number on one side of the teeter-totter, and who are the people who are going to oppose you, and it's a huge number, including many of your personal friends, that's the nature of our political system. That's the nature of our democracy. And those of us who care about changing our foreign policy so that it's just and dignified and thoughtful and reasonable and honorable, we've got to also be serious in analyzing what it would take to achieve that. And we're so far from pushing and supporting a president going in the direction that I perceive both you and I would like to see.
Many of us are surprised that we have a black president. Maybe there's a surprise in store for us yet?
Fair enough. And life is based on hope. And we should, in fact, hope. We should, in fact, learn from the changes that have come that we didn't expect. The other side of the coin is we need to be more brutally realistic with how we got into this predicament and more brutally realistic about how our system works and not get deceived and trapped in false and deceptive agreements, as, for instance, the Oslo one was, and it only made things immensely worse than they were at the time. We all, in my case, I wasn't so supportive, but even I was reduced to just sort of being relatively quiet about it and waiting to see if my fears happened. And as it turned out, I was wrong. It got much, much worse than even I predicted. I admire the work you're doing, and I admire people like you who are in touch with people, reaching out to people, looking for new ideas, trying to give people like me a voice at a very difficult time. And I would love nothing better than to wear my Obama scarf and celebrate like other people are doing. But I think there's also a role for experts and intellectuals and analysts to look at the situation not from the perspective of their hope, but from the perspective of what they've learned ever since they studied these issues and went to school and read the books and met the people and gone through what they've gone through. I think if we're more realistic about the predicament we're in, then we'd have at least a better chance of actually doing something about it.
Mark Brzezinski, thank you so much for joining us.
Dory, thank you very much.
You can learn more about international law and politics expert Mark Brzezinski at MiddleEast.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. I'm Dory Smith. We dedicate this program and our future work to my father, the late David Truscoff.